Well, that song, if you've never heard it before, is Iris by the Goo Goo Dolls in the 90s. We're watching, Heather and I are watching a show right now. Somebody's kid says, who the heck are the, what's a Goo Goo Doll? I don't know what a Goo Goo Doll is, but it was a great band in the 90s. I do know that. It's a song that always has made me think of Jesus when I hear it. Just every time I've heard it. So I hope you all had a very Merry Christmas. As we approach the new year, people are typically taking inventory in their lives, planning new things. Oh, I wanted to apologize to Joaquin and Paula, specifically by name, that we won't be able to play games and hang out today. But we'll be back doing that next week. So if you guys come back, you are more than welcome. And I'm sorry that we missed it this week. We're doing a little bit of planning now, right? Taking some inventory. Maybe there's some things that you'd like to do a little bit more of this year, or some things you'd like to do a little bit less of this year. So I want to share some things to think about this year as you strategize your new you for 2026. For me, well, it's pretty simple. Just getting back to doing morning yoga and getting back to regular exercise. There's a lot more, but I'm just going to take those on in January. We'll see how I do with those. So this morning, I want to jump back in a bit in the Gospel of John, go back to a chapter that Peter's already covered, and hang out a little longer with a blind man whose sight Jesus restored. So in John chapter 9, if you remember, Jesus heals a man born blind, and by putting mud on his eyes and telling him to go wash in the pool of Siloam, which means scent. The man fumbles and stumbles his way, you know, to the pool. I guess he was born for life, so he probably didn't fumble and stumble as much as I would because he was used to getting there, not being able to see, but looked like a fool with this mud on his face, right, as he goes. He goes to the pool, he washes, his sight is restored. So cue the suspenseful music. They seem offended. Oh, no, sorry. Cue the suspenseful music. I don't have any. It's not a bad on the media team. Didn't give it to them. I got to calm down, breathe, take a breath. Got too many things going, so just bear with me. The man fumbles and stumbles his way to the pool, washes, and his sight is restored. This sets the religious leaders off on a little inquisition. They seem offended that the blind man has had his sight restored. He's super excited about it. He's very clear with them how excited he is about it. They question the man, and then his parents, and then the man again, attempting to find out how his sight was restored. Well, he's super stoked, and he's told them that Jesus is the one who healed him. The religious leaders don't share his enthusiasm about that, if you remember. And John says they cast him out. That's where we're going to pick up the story today. So John 9, 35, Jesus heard that they had cast him out. And having found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" He answered, "And who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?" Jesus said to him, "You have seen him, and it is he who is speaking to you." He said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. Jesus said, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind." Some of the Pharisees near him heard these things and said to him, "Are we blind also?" Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say we see, your guilt remains." So we're going to start in the first part of this. And I want to ask the question, who are you? You can't start planning for 2026 if you haven't figured out who you are. You can't figure out who you're going to be, right? So who are you? Who are you? Who am I? Who are we? Are you defined by your circumstances? You're most likely shaped by them, but do they define you? Maybe a little. Sometimes. I think it's interesting that Jesus puts the blind man in our story through the pain and humiliation of being cast out. He doesn't save him from that event. He actually sends him out on that journey by covering his eyes with mud and saying, "You've got to find your way to the pool. You've got to get healed." Obviously, Christ, knowing what was going to come, you know, says, "You got to go through what's going to come after that." I suspect that even with an instant fix, with his eyesight restored right now, that his heart would still be unchanged because he had identified for so long as a blind man, and it would have been challenging for him to undo all of his life's worth of identity as a blind person, right? He's learned to live life that way for decades. Well, we don't know how long, but probably decades, right? He's probably 20s, 30s, 40s, whatever. Those are decades, nonetheless. That's a long time and a lot of baggage to work through. Have you ever experienced being cast out? I think he's shared a story about that. I'm not sure. Joking. Of course he's experienced being cast out in a way that we probably will never experience. But I've experienced it. You've experienced it. We've all been cast out of various things in our lives. Have you ever felt that Jesus is as close to heaven as you'll ever be? I've often struggled with that, feelings of being worthy of the salvation that I've been handed as a gift. Oftentimes in prayer saying, why me, Lord? I mean, of all the people in the world, why would you work in my life? And why would you call me to follow you? I'm messed up. My favorite author is Stephen King. My favorite director is Quentin Tarantino. And my favorite band is Metallica. None of that fits really well in the traditional Christian world. I felt not worthy of salvation. And guilty sometimes because I have it. And it feels wasted sometimes on me. So surely there are better choices out there to do your will, Lord. Well, anyway, so back to Jesus. He hears that the man has been cast out by the religious leaders. And then that's when he goes and seeks him out. He seeks him out. He finds him, not to console him. He doesn't seek him out to gripe with him about how terrible the religious leaders are, but to ask him a simple question. Do you believe? I think Jesus knew the man was stuck identifying as a blind man and needed to go through the process of being emptied of self. We think of self as really bad sometimes, really bad, and not like just natural. But a lot of our self, capital S-E-L-F, our self, our inside, our inner man, our Mises, Peter has 1,000 terms for it, right? But that thing inside us that is us, just pure unadulterated us minus God, is self, right? And it's not always evil, bad. It could just be kind of bad. It's human bad, right? It's our human condition is the way that I would title it. But I think he needed to go through that process of being emptied of that self some. Maybe that was, it can be pride. It could have been for him just identity, right? This is how I get by. This is what I do. I raise money by sitting outside this gate because I'm blind and people give me money and I can't work, right? That's what I do. Now you took away that, so I have to adjust. I have to figure out who I am now. That process can be really hard, and vulnerability is hard, but I think vulnerability is always worth it. I love the sentence in here, and he worshiped him. It's a beautiful scene unfolding there. A picture of the foot of the cross. This is a picture of that intimate place where we are known and know. Walls come down, and the man sees Jesus for who he is. He sees that he belongs with Jesus. And I'd give up forever to touch you, because I know that you feel me somehow. You're the closest to heaven that I'll ever be, and I don't want to go home right now. Broken and surrendered, the formerly blind man feels safe as he is. All I can taste is this moment. All I can breathe is your life. Sooner or later, it's over. I just don't want to miss you tonight. It's intimate. Jesus asks him to do a hard thing, waits for him to do it, waits for him to be ridiculed and cast out because of it, and then seeks him out. I think we can learn a lot from this story if we sit with it for a while. Think through what the interactions must have been like, what the experience was like. Jesus seeks him out after all of this and simply extends an invitation. Do you believe? I can hear Jesus saying in his heart, I just want you to know who I am. Some of the things I love about this account in John is I believe the invitation is issued when the man's heart is ready to receive it. Right? We don't know the reasons. We don't know why the mud, why the spit, it's gross. Is it for the purpose of, we don't know. We speculate, but we don't know what the purpose was. For me, I believe that the purpose was Jesus is Jesus. He's God. He knows the man's heart. He knows if I turn you right here, it's not going to go as well, right? You're not ready. You're not ready yet. You need to convince yourself that you're ready to believe. And so I need you to go on this journey. He's not coerced. He's not forced. He's not pinned down to say uncle. I also really like the fleeting nature of this moment because it's interesting, but a reminder to me of what it's like to live with God in our space-time. How many of you have had those moments where you feel that way? Oh no, this is going to end. This is going to end. I have to wake up tomorrow or, you know, I don't want to leave your presence, right? I want to stay here. I want it to be like this, but I know I have to go to work tomorrow. After death, we enter into God's dimension, the greater unknown. Death here, birth there. But for now, we live in a linear time dimension through which God flows. And when we tap into that, it's heavenly, right? We call it heavenly for a reason. This changed I also like the changed nature of the formerly blind man, his utter excitement to share his life-altering experience, right? He has forgotten about being cast out. He's like, hey, I think it's awesome I can see. Like, did you notice? I know you want to know who did this and why and how and all the details, but I can see now and I'm really excited about it. They're like, yeah. More about that later. Tell us exactly who it was. Point to him. And after a beautiful time of worship, I like the return to the world, back to the struggle, back to reality as we experience it in our lifetime, because it gives me hope. Because when those moments end for me and I get up and go to work, I go to church, so it's different, but I get up and go somewhere the next day. I mean, work is work. We work in a church. Yeah, it's great. It's good, but it's still work, right? There's still things you have to work through. So there's still hard things, right, waiting for you on Monday. I don't want to make it sound like it's a burden to work at the sanctuary. That's what I'm trying to undo there. Like at the end of a great burger, right? The last bite. No, no. Or walking out of a great movie. You feel like you could take on the world and all you did was just watch some superheroes take on the world for 2 hours, right? But you know that feeling when you walk out and you're like, yes, let's do this. Like, let's go. Or other things that you can think of on your own, because I have kids here that are listening. But I don't want the world to see me, because I don't think that they'd understand. When everything's meant to be broken, I just want you to know who I am. Jesus seems to understand our struggle with being human, our concern over someone else seeing who we really are. Vulnerability is scary to us. He did it some, even, often telling his disciples, don't tell others about this, okay? Not yet. And we can get into the theology and the details of the why, but he did it. That's all I'm saying. Can't argue with that because it's right there in the print, right? Don't tell anyone about this yet. But only when others see our pain can they join us in it. And only when we see someone else's pain can we join them in it. Not necessarily to fix it, but to be present for them, to see a deeper them, empathetically. When we hide our pain, we're left to deal with it on our own, alone. We can easily hide it from others. We pretend that we can hide it from God, but we seem to all know at our core that we can't hide it from God. Even the most ardent atheist has been known to cry out to God in a moment of intense pain or suffering. Dustin Kinsrew of the band Thrice says it this way: one day all our scars will disappear like the stars at dawn, drowned out by the light. But until then, while we're bound to this space-time, all our scars still remain. But we're learning that if we'll open the wounds and share them, then soon they start to heal. Being vulnerable is not a weakness. It's a strength. Jesus is all about overcoming the world. All about it in our space-time. But he's about doing it from the inside out. I think he's about a victory over self. Capital S, capital E, capital L, capital F. That big thing that we all deal with, that human condition. I know you've been hurt. I know you're going to be hurt again. I know that I've been hurt. I know that I'm going to be hurt again. I know that I've hurt and I'm going to hurt again. But hear me on this. Focusing on the need for reckoning is not mercy. Even if your desire for reckoning is for a really, really, really bad person. So why are we here? Why are you here? Why am I here? Why are we here? Well, what's so special about this space-time in which we exist? What's so special about this linear journey through time that we're riding on in the Milky Way? We are here. This is the universe. That's the Milky Way, that little circle. We can't even get into our universe. I mean, we can't even get into our solar system there. We are here. It's worth noting also, as a side note, that the demons asked Jesus the very same question in a couple of accounts in the Gospels. What are you doing here? What are you doing here? But that's a story for another time. We're here because we're part of a vast universe. We're here. We are there to experience life with others. We're not all there is. We're just all there is that's visible to us, right? There's more. There's way more, actually. This thing pans out even further, and I think the largest guess is 2 trillion galaxies in the universe. Galaxies, and those are, it's unbelievable, right? We're part of something that's so huge that we can't see most of it. This is an artist rendering based on what they believe that it looks like. We can't get telescopes out that far. But we're not all there is. In a way, we're all blind people too. We're surrounded by a kingdom that we can't see with our eyes, but it's right around us all the time. The victory on the cross is done. It's finished. It's not still being worked out. There aren't details to nail out. There isn't a peace treaty that's got to be signed, any of that stuff. It's done. It's finished. It is over, and it has paid what needed to be paid, and it's done. It's finished. We live in a finished condition, but we still live in our space-time. So we still are on a linear timeline that lives with a larger dimensions around it, larger dimensions that encapsulate our linear timeline, right? So if you've seen the Flatlanders videos, you know what I'm talking about. It goes from flat to two-dimensional to three-dimensional to four-dimensional, all the way out to 11, which is ridiculous if you try to understand the 11th dimension. It's good luck on that. But it's fully dimensional where we live while we exist in only part of its dimensions. That causes us problems as human beings. We humans want to explain every single thing to the point in which all mysteries have been explained away. But here we are. We're designed for intimate moments like the one that we see in John 9. That's why we're here. These moments of worship and divine connection. In our flesh, we often strive to fill this desire with other people, with substances, with control, with religion, politics. We seek the intimacy that we're designed to have with God from other sources, sources that we can control. Safer sources, I guess, if you will. At least we think they're safer. In this world, our space-time, we tend to exert ourselves and feed the desires of those selves. It's our human condition. Greed, control, manipulation, personal gain, pride, proud self-confidence, right? These things aren't evil, but they lead to what I would describe as evil. If I describe evil in the way that Peter describes evil, as an absence of the presence of God or sin. Not God withdrawing from us, but us withdrawing from God, at least believing that we are. As we protect ourselves, capital S, capital E, capital L, capital V, capital E, capital S, through fight, flight, freezing, or fawning, whichever one we gravitate toward, we have life, light, inside of us. The very thing that we're searching for, that we're seeking, is there already. Let's go back to John. And in the second part, Jesus says something interesting, I think. He always says something interesting. Jesus said, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see me may see, and those who see may become blind." Some of the Pharisees near him heard these things and said to him, "Are we also blind?" And Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say we see, your guilt remains." From a traditional Christian worldview, the second part of Jesus' statement is a bit confusing. Jesus says he came into the world that those who see may become blind. We're pretty comfortable with the "those who are blind may see" part. But this second part makes my Christian friends start to squirm a little bit when we're together. Well, I'm not giving this a full theological treatment this morning. You can do that on your own if you're interested. I'd also be interested to talk with you sometime over lunch or coffee about it. But let's just sit with the observation for a bit. It's what he said. Let's allow wonder and mystery to be wonder and mystery. Well, the Pharisees, or the religious leaders in our story, are driven by proud self-confidence. Their hard, unbroken selves. This sculpture I shared before, I love this sculpture. It was made for a Burning Man by a Ukrainian artist named Alexander Milov. It captures what that might look like, I think. The hard exterior selves sitting back to back with the small childlike light inside trying to reach out to touch someone else, or touching someone else. And you can't fight the tears that ain't coming, or the moment of truth in your lies. When everything feels like the movies, yeah, you bleed just to know you're alive. In Matthew 6, Jesus tells us, "The eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness?" Not "how great" as in "how great thou art," but "great" as in "how immense is the darkness." How much of an extent, an amount, or an intensity considerably above the normal or average is the darkness, if the light in you is darkness? The Amplified Version says it this way: "But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness, devoid of God's precepts." I strike the apostrophe S, precepts, on that and just read it. I think the way it seems like it makes more sense to me. Your whole body will be full of darkness, devoid of God. Not just his precepts, it's devoid of God. So if the very light inside you, your inner self, your heart, your conscience is dark, how great and terrible is that darkness? Well, John Ruskin, a Victorian art critic, wrote a 5-volume work in the mid-1800s entitled Modern Painters. Probably never heard of it. I never had. In it, he included detailed art analysis combined with religious and philosophical ideas about beauty and truth. And he says, "Seeing falsely is worse than blindness. A man who is too dim-sighted to discern the road from the ditch may feel which is which. But if the ditch appears manifestly to him to be the road, and the road to be the ditch, what shall become of him?" False seeing is unseeing on the negative side of blindness. I would argue that that same analogy also applies to the Romans road. I'll read it again. "Seeing falsely is worse than blindness. A man who is too dim-sighted to discern the road from the ditch, is able to feel which is which. But if the ditch appears manifestly to him to be the road, and the road to be the ditch, what shall become of him? False seeing is unseeing on the negative side of blindness. The Romans road to me seems like a manipulative answer created for unbelievers to encounter God, right? I can make it happen for you. But if the ditch appears manifestly to the blind teller of the story to be the road, and the road to be the ditch, what shall become of the teller? And what shall become of the person to which the story is told? The Pharisees' hearts, I think, are preventing them from seeing and believing. It's head knowledge versus heart understanding. They can't embrace the wonder of it all. They aren't sad about what's going on because they're unaware of it. Their tears aren't coming. There aren't any tears to shed. I'm right. So what would I be sad about? What do I need to shed tears for? Jesus doesn't seem stressed out about that fact. He doesn't warn them that it may be too late for them or that they might run out of time to get it right. Which is interesting to me. I've said this before. I'll say it many, many more times before I die. I think this moment is one of the greatest arguments against eternal conscious torment. If anyone would have had a proper understanding of that concept, it would have been Jesus Christ. And in that moment, he would have said something to them. Hey, here's something you should know. You're going to want to know about this. You're going to wish I told you about this later if I don't. So I just think it's worth mentioning. You could be destined to eternal torment. Doesn't mention it. Instead, he simply states their condition, much like a doctor issuing a diagnosis. I do think that he's thinking, oh, I just want you to know who I am. He's exercising the judgment for which he came into our lives, into our space-time. Mercy. Jesus is the moment of truth in their lives, and that's what drives them nuts. That's what makes them angry. Even in our proud self-confidence, of which we all suffer on occasion, God's Spirit, his light in us, longs to connect with those around us. It is the moment of truth in our lies. We're quick, or at least the lies that the enemy convinces us of or tries to get us to believe. We're quick to see Pharisaical ways in others, but not so quick to see it in ourselves. Ourselves, capital S, capital E, capital L, capital V, capital E, capital S, temper the light that shines in each of us. But ourselves aren't capable of overpowering the light completely, running it all out of us, damning us to eternal conscious torment, I don't think. I think God is like a pilot light inside each of us that can't be snuffed out. I think it's true for me. I think it's true for you. I think it's true for those we love. I think it's true for those we hate, or if that's too strong a word, struggle to love. As we sit back to back, angry with our neighbor, the childlike spirit of God inside us longs to connect with that very neighbor. The spirit longs to connect with that neighbor through us. And what's our response? Well, I know what mine is sometimes. Seriously, God? That neighbor? Really? You don't have someone else you could send to that neighbor? Perhaps we just need to take a moment to see the light in our neighbor's eyes. So what is it that makes us special? That brings us back to the song title. I don't know what you know about your iris, but it's pretty cool that it's what gives you pretty eyes if you have pretty eyes. I wasn't blessed with pretty eyes. I have brown eyes. Scientists, I didn't put this, but I have to say it. Scientists have said that they've determined that the base color of all irises is blue. And then from there, other elements enter into your body and you become full of something else and it changes the color of your iris. I was told as a kid what I was full of was, well, my eyes are brown, so you can figure it out. And I probably am, so I don't think my parents were too far off on that one. Your iris is the muscle that regulates the amount of light that's allowed into your body. It increases and decreases your pupil size, regulating the amount of light that gets through. Kind of looks familiar too, a little bit, not a lot, but if you remember the picture of the universe, if you were to turn that sideways, there's a thing in the middle that kind of bulges out, like just like our eyes, like our lens in the front. It's pretty interesting to me. Each of your irises is unique. They're like snowflakes and they're like fingerprints. Even our two irises are different from one another. Take a minute to look into a neighbor's eyes. Just look directly at their iris. Sorry, Bill, you can get your phone out. I'll come down and look in your eye. Take a minute to look. You can't tell that just by looking, but their left one is actually different from their right one. Well, there's an Australian company called Iris Photo, that's who made this photo, who specializes in high-powered iris photos. If you were looking at one of their photos, you could see the differences in your neighbor's eyes because they blow it up and they enhance it and then they add kind of color to it. But Iris Photo says this about their statement of belief. We believe that every pair of eyes tells a story, a narrative of depth and individuality waiting to be captured. Our passion lies in the artistry of preserving these tales, transforming them into stunning pieces of high-gloss artwork. There's even a company now in Europe that started turning them into jewelry so that you can wear your iris or you could give it to a loved one to wear or whatever you would do with that. Your iris is like your fingerprints, and both are similar to you. You also are very unique. You are the only you in the world full of people. One of the earliest influences in my walk with Jesus was a guy I only know as Pastor Mike. He was the guitar-playing pastor of a little 125-year-old unimpressive farm church that Heather's family attended in Bellpoint, Ohio. I would come along begrudgingly. Pastor Mike wrote a song for the children's ministry once that he often sang for the kids during the children's sermon on Sundays. They were Methodists, so they would bring the kids up and give a little sermon to the kids. And it was called "I Am Special." Look, he wasn't going to win a Grammy with this thing, okay? But everybody loved it. It was, all the adults, it became a beloved song in the church. We loved doing it. All the adults sang along, or you see toes tapping. And it was pretty simple. The chorus was, "I am special. That's a word that's hard to spell, but it means a lot to me. It means I'm special, special, special. I am special. I have the whole world to tell. God made no one just like me. I am special, special, special." And Pastor Mike, I just blessed me with sharing his gifts of music. He was a fun guitar player, and he loved Jesus unabashedly. He inspired me early on to use my gifts for good and to pursue God with reckless abandon. You see that hair, right? It was reckless abandon. So what do I do now? What do we do now? What do you do now where we are? Well, more scripture. In 1 Corinthians 4, Paul tells us this. "This is how one should regard us, as servants of Christ and servants of the mysteries of God." Stewards of the mysteries of God. Being a steward means responsibly managing something entrusted to your care, acting as a trustworthy caretaker. God entrusted this whole thing to an infant, so it's not about control. It's about surrender. We're called to a simple task, and that is a very difficult task to do. We are called to re-gift this present. This is our great commission. Not to unpack it, not to read the instructions for it to everyone that you meet, not to throw it at someone and run away, not to leave it in the bathroom for someone to find, not to use it as a weapon to make yourself great. We're called to share, to re-gift this gift Paul Young, in his book, The Shack, shares a picture of this Great Commission. The main character in the book, Mac, is facing a monster in his life. Someone he doesn't like and doesn't want to like due to a horrific event that this person did and that affected his life. Mac is struggling with the wake that a really bad person left in his life. Mac encounters the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit in his pain. And at one point, he asks Jesus, "So what do I do now?" And Jesus replies, "What you're already doing, Mac, learning to live loved. It's not an easy concept for humans. You have a hard time sharing anything." He chuckled and continued, "So yes, what we desire is for you to return to us, being the Trinity, God, the Son, the Holy Spirit, and then we come and make our home inside you, and then we share. The friendship is real, not merely imagined. We're meant to experience this life, your life, together in a dialogue, sharing the journey." So Sanctuary, you're doing it. You're doing the what now. Continue to surrender to the light within you. Learn to live loved, and you will love back. It's a process. It's not a box to check off. But it's important to note that it comes before love your neighbor as yourself. If your love of self is unholy, your love for your neighbor will be unholy. If your love of self is ungodly, your love of your neighbor will be ungodly. If your love of self is selfish, your love of your neighbor will be selfish. If you can fit all you believe onto a hat, shirt, bumper sticker, or yard sign, I would say you don't believe enough. If you can reduce your neighbor to what's on theirs, I would say you can't love enough. But I encourage us all to tap into the mysteries of God and let them be mysteries, to have your mind blown and your heart changed. And that's how you blow the minds of others and the heart and help them to allow their hearts to change. Live your story. Tell your story. Share your story. Share your gifts with those around you. I consider neighbors whoever's in around you, right? The kingdom of God is at hand. So are your neighbors. They're at hand. You are a unique child of God with a unique experience in our space-time. And so is your neighbor. In life, through struggles and good times, hear Jesus when he says, "I like you." I think he says it more often than we want to admit, and to more people than we want to admit. As grown-ups, we can be pretty complicated. But really, our purpose here is pretty simple. I think I printed the wrong message. No. Bear with me a minute. Yeah, well, anyway, we'll get to that in a minute. I think that Fred Rogers communicates this view of how Jesus would say it to us best. But I'll let you hear that in a minute. But the what next is surrender. We can't share this present with those around us if we are living out ourself alone. Exercise your muscles, open your eyes wider, and let the light consume you. We need our inner child like spirit to be activated and flooded with God, who is love. Or is it flooded with love, who is God? That's six of one, half a dozen of the other. Then we need to give others in our lives room to do that also. We have to let them have the space that they need to do that. Even if you think they're not capable, we're not called to make that judgment. I've had the pleasure of watching this happen recently. I didn't ask permission, I apologize. Half of this group is here. But guys, Grub and Grace meets once a month in the foyer here, and there's not much agenda, there's not much structure, but it's a rich time together. And I've gotten to watch, well, two things that are amazing to me. There are folks who come to that regularly who do not come to church because they like the fellowship. And there are friendships that just happen there because people find people that they connect with, right? So watching Paul and Michael grow in their friendship together has just been an awesome privilege. And they sharpen each other. Their families are friends, and it's a beautiful thing. I also get to see it when I was volunteering at the food bank. And Shelley, you have been there, and Sandy has been there in the past. And there's just a really great time of camaraderie and working together that's really beautiful that happens during those times of connection. So connect where you are in life. Bring your unique self wrapped in God's love to those around you, your neighbors. If we can help, let me know, let John know, let Peter know, let someone know, and we'll do what we can. But it's largely your privilege. Our hope is that how you connect with others through the week is fueled by our time together here. So keep connecting with others. Sasha, I don't have any idea where I am, so I apologize. So I'm just going to go to communion now. So on the night he was betrayed by all of us looking to consume him, we consumers, he broke bread saying, "This is my body broken for you. Take and eat." In the same manner, he poured wine saying, "This is my blood poured out for the forgiveness of sins. Drink of it, all of you." All are invited to the table here at the sanctuary. You guys, I think, all know that. Take a piece of the bread, dip it in the wine. Say to him, "I just want you to know who I am." Eat his body and drink his blood. Weird, huh? Mysteries of God can be a little bit weird. Hear him say back to you, "I just want you to know who I am," and worship him. This week, when you're thinking about the new you for 2026, remember that God loves you. He's constantly inviting you to live, truly live. So stop and listen for Jesus. He's constantly telling you that he likes you, not the stuff that surrounds you or makes you up. I think this video from Mr. Fred Rogers kind of sums it up best.
You know, human beings learn best and most from other human beings. That's all part of being human. And we learn best from people who really care about us, people we really like. It's you I like. It's not the things you wear. It's not the way you do your hair. But it's you I like. The way you are right now. The way down deep inside you. Not the things that hide you. Not your toys. They're just beside you. But it's you I like. Every part of you. Your skin, your eyes, your feelings, whether old or new. I hope that you'll remember, even when you're feeling blue, that it's you I like. It's you yourself. It's you, it's you I like, and that's true, and you'll find that the people who love you best are the ones you learn the most from, and the more they teach you, and the more you learn, the better feeling you have about yourself and the world we live in.
The point here being that God likes you. He wants you to be who you are. He's not asking you to be a different person. He's not asking me to be a different person. He simply wants us to be the person that he made, the person that he loves. We're unique for a reason. He's constantly saying, "I like you. I created you for good. I want to be with you always. And I just want you to know who I am." There's a Brené Brown quote that I was inserting here that my wife and I have gone back and forth about whether it should be inserted or not. Because, you know, let's face it, Brené's about self, right? But I like the quote. True belonging never asks us to change who we are. True belonging requires us to be who we are. And I don't see why it can't fit in our world with God as well. Because God has created us uniquely. Why? Why create everyone uniquely if the whole point is to get them to all be the same? That doesn't make any sense to me. And I like you guys, too. I love each and every one of you, and I'm so blessed to get to partner with you in sharing the greatest gift of all. I'm especially excited for this new year ahead. I feel a tide turning on the relentless love of God in the world. And some of you, a lot of you, almost all of you have shared with me privately, you feel that same tide turning. It's been a long road. We've been alone for a long time, but I don't think we have to be alone for too much longer. We'll see. But right now, we're working on the final details for a conference in the fall. This one looks like it's going to happen, unlike the last one. So if that is something that you're interested in, it'll be something focused on the message of God's relentless love. I don't really care for the word conference too much myself, but I am excited for this gathering. And I think it will be more of a homecoming to our Sanctuary Abroad members and those people scattered across the nation and across the world. More details are coming on that soon, as soon as some more pieces fall in and are finalized, but they're looking good. If you would like to use your gifts to help with that conference, please do reach out to me via email or via text. A lot of you have expressed interest in passing in the past, and that's great in the moment, but as soon as I get home, if I don't have the text or the email, then I'm probably not going to remember who I had that conversation with. So those really helped me a lot. So shoot me an email or a text if you're interested in helping. We'll need a lot of help. We'll need some committee chairs and things of that nature to help guide people and do all the things that we want to do. But hey, 2026 is going to be a great year. We're going to do some amazing things together. And I'm looking forward to that. So I guess in way of benediction, just be the gospel. Amen.